the recent moves towards bringing much more industry and advanced manufacturing to the Midwest. Frankly, I can only applaud that because, let's face it, the Midwest folks know how to build things. It's in their DNA, as I put it.
Hi, and welcome to the first episode of Season 3 of the City Age Podcast. I'm Alon Markovich, and I'm here with our new co-host, Lisa Chamberlain. Lisa, first off, welcome aboard. We are so thrilled to have you join us, and I know our City Age audience is going to love you.
Oh, well, thank you for that, and I am very excited to be here.
For those in our audience who don't know you, Lisa, I thought I would give them an intro. So Lisa is an urban strategist and former New York Times real estate reporter whose communication skills are abundantly clear if you follow her on LinkedIn. I think her feed is one of the most vibrant and insightful LinkedIn streams anywhere related to the built environment or cities around the world. Lisa's now with the Center for Urban Transformation at the World Economic Forum. And as such, she has a global view of urban issues. And I think one that you'll all hear comes through in her conversations with our guests throughout the season.
I've known City Age for years now. I've been to many events that have taken place over the past 12 years. And so it feels kind of serendipitous to now be part of the podcast.
It's weird, right? You and I met in Detroit, and we'll be going back to Detroit soon. And Detroit is particularly appropriate for today. So let's get to it. The voice which kicked off today's episode is that of Kofi Bonner, the CEO of Bedrock Detroit.
Kofi, he's had quite the personal and professional journey, kind of like Detroit has. He was born in Ghana, where he earned a bachelor's degree and then came to the United States to attend UC Berkeley, where he earned two master's degrees, actually, in architecture and planning. And then he went on to hold a number of public and private sector positions in San Francisco, Oakland, and Emeryville, focused primarily on planning, economic development, and affordable housing. After spearheading numerous major redevelopment projects all over the Bay Area, he left to become the first Black CEO of an NFL football team, the Cleveland Browns. This was at a time when the city was rebuilding not only the team, but a new stadium after the team had departed to Baltimore. So it was a critical moment. And he's now the CEO of Bedrock, which is the Detroit real estate arm of the Rocket family of companies owned by Dan Gilbert, who also owns the Cleveland Cavaliers. So Kofi has a number of different vantage points on cities, on economic development, and on the cultural and intangible things that make a place equitable and vibrant. And we talk about a number of those in the interview.
Well, that's a great place to leave it and to let everyone hear the conversation that you had with Kofi Bonner, CEO of Bedrock Detroit.
Kofi Bonner, welcome to the City Age podcast. I'm really excited that we're chatting today.
Yes. Yes, indeed. I appreciate the opportunity.
So I'll just jump in. You clearly have a wide range of personal and professional experiences, from developing affordable housing to investing in fintech companies, working in the public sector in San Francisco and Emeryville, to running the Cleveland Browns. How has all of this informed your view of cities, how they develop, how cultural context impacts the way people live in them?
What I've observed, I guess, about cities along the way is just how organic they are in many ways, and also how dynamic. And what do I mean? I mean, cities, obviously, you know, both people and culture, economics and the marketplace, and politics. And each of those components are dynamic in nature and evolve and change with time. And what I found is so many cities are in sort of different stages of evolution, and even as they're evolving and changing, they're compared against each other, but somewhat unfairly in some respects, because again, the people, the economics and marketplace and the politics of those places are so different. When I was in Cleveland, for example, the downtown was quite vibrant. Tower City was amazing, and all the national retailers, and was just the place to be. It was the heart of downtown in many ways. I left and went to San Francisco, and San Francisco was beginning its tremendous upswing. This is in 2005 in the tech boom, and it obviously continued on that upswing all the way till more recently. And now, of course, there are many conversations about where San Francisco is in its evolution, but certainly it's one would say, has taken somewhat of a step back. It's evolving. And here I am now in Detroit with a significant public partnership with the city of Cleveland and working with the city to, again, evolve and move that city back to its some economic prominence and reviving the downtown.
I would say it's very interesting that Detroit's history can offer some lessons to places like San Francisco, because they both had a situation where a certain sector became really dominant in the city and created a bit of a monoculture. And who would have guessed that a city like San Francisco would go from enormous success to struggling so quickly? What can that city take away from Detroit's evolution and how it has recovered?
Well, I think San Francisco is beginning to do it. As you pointed out, there was such a so much attractiveness, I guess. The attraction for tech and a certain kind of tech was so great that it began to dominate the economy, to the point where others that were really strong up in, and continue to be strong, but they were being crowded out of the marketplace. And and biotech in life sciences, for example, was and is a very strong market sector in San Francisco proper, and certainly in the adjacent cities too, in South San Francisco. And those companies are finding it a little harder to compete for the space in downtown. With the advent of all the technology companies that were locating in downtown and seemingly had an endless appetite for real estate, as their appetite has significantly diminished, it has created this sort of vacancy in downtown. And I think, if anything, San Francisco is now trying to diversify as much as it possibly can. Whereas certainly back in the Detroit's heyday, the big three certainly dominated the economic landscape, and there's no question about it. They're still very prominent, but there's a great deal more diversity in the economy here in Detroit. It's amazing that the top four or so sectors, industry sectors, health, are all relatively evenly distributed, with healthcare and government, manufacturing, and professional science and technical services. They're all fairly evenly distributed through the economic sector here in Detroit. And I think that's what has created much more resilience, perhaps, in Detroit.
Yeah, I find it rather remarkable that Detroit is recovering faster than places like Boston and Los Angeles. And this is on the heels of Detroit filing bankruptcy just 10 years ago.
I don't think it could be said enough that it's only been 10 and a half or so years since bankruptcy, which one would say is sort of the bottom rung, right? It's the largest American city ever to file bankruptcy. It's certainly nothing to be proud about. But I think Detroit can certainly be proud about the fact that 10 years later, we're having a conversation about Detroit being one of the rising stars in the urban economic landscape. And I think you're right to say, well, what are those factors? And, you know, I've been here 3 years now. And so I would say much of the credit goes to those who have been here for the last 10 years. I think, first and foremost, the city was able to get its collective act together under the leadership of Mayor Mike Duggan. I think he's done an extraordinary job marshaling all the civic and political leaders to just support a vision where he could literally step by step rebuild the fabric, the economic fabric of the city. And would say that component of alignment between the political establishment, the broader civic establishment, and the private sector, with strong leadership from the private sector, I think are key components of this revitalization.
It really has been a true public-private collaboration. And I use that word collaboration on purpose, because it's not just government and private sector, but communities, individuals, neighborhoods, philanthropy, investors, it's an all hands on deck situation.
It has been. It has been and continues to be. And I believe that perhaps Detroit, because we're so far down, it rallied folks to sort of wake up and recognize what they had and how they craft a path to get to where they want to go. And that sense of urgency has really manifested itself in what we have today. Whereas perhaps some of the other cities, they were perhaps coasting in some fashion.
Yeah, taking their success for granted at a time when Detroit was doing the hard work of rebuilding.
Not to name them, but I think that certainly has been somewhat the case. And I will also say that when you are rebuilding, literally rebuilding every block, you care about all the components. Obviously, you care, and Detroit was blessed with a number of significant buildings with great architecture, but unfortunately, they've been vacated as the economy crashed. And we've had the pleasure of rebuilding and reusing those buildings and taking them from where they were to now Class A facilities that are occupied by, national tenants. But what that has done, the large number of buildings that have been historically repaired with the care and attention that we've paid to detail, has created this, what I consider to be one of the most elegant and beautiful cityscapes along certainly Woodward Avenue and certainly in other portions of the downtown too. And that also creates this wonderful feel. A feeling of downtown.
Absolutely.
And of course, we populate that with people and activities and intentional activations. It just fills up the space in a manner that I think has really helped support the growth and changing of the image of downtown.
It is remarkable because Bedrock has rehabilitated and repurposed more than 100 buildings. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And this is all in the downtown core and just in the last 12 years.
I know you have a love for Cleveland too. 100 also includes some buildings in Cleveland, but I think we're around about 118 now.
So let's talk about the most recent rehabilitation, Book Tower, which was at one time the tallest building in Detroit. It's an iconic building of Detroit, and it was left completely abandoned and dilapidated after many years of decline. Paint a picture of Book Tower because it really is a stunner. The discovery of the glass and crystal dome that had been buried under a bunch of other construction and was discovered during the rehabilitation, that is a story in itself.
Well, just imagine, the story of Book Tower, is really fascinating, I think, because it was built in 1926 or so. And it was, as you point out, the tallest building in Detroit. And think of 1926. Detroit was one of the most prominent cities in America. And here's this street, Washington Boulevard, that was created to essentially rival any other city in the world. It was supposed to feel like Paris. And Book Tower has the elegance and detail of any building in Europe. And it was built in 1926, filled with offices, very prominent companies filled it. And then as the economy turned, this building fell into disrepair. But as it was turning, and as Detroit was turning, and people tried to make better use of the spaces inside or make use of the spaces to match the market that they were in, they started covering things up. And when maintenance got too tough, they just let it go. And so it fell into disrepair. And this beautiful glass dome of which you speak was actually covered because they created an extra floor space to rent on the floor. So you could not see the dome from the ground floor. It was covered to add additional floor space to the top, to second and third floors. And that was the condition under which Bedrock found the building. Seven years ago, we purchased that building. And slowly and carefully, with great consultants and a great team of Bedrock folks, returned this building, this historic building. It was about 400,000 square feet of office in its initial life, is now 117 hotel rooms. It's 229 apartments, about 50,000 square feet of office, but it's enlivened by these really wonderful retail and restaurant spaces, and one of which is ironically a French brasserie that just opened 3 weeks ago, Le Supreme. It has a beautiful event space and has this wonderful roof terrace bar. I mean, it's just this wonderful sense of how to take an old building that was built for a specific use and convert it into a mixed use structure so that those who are living within it have all these wonderful amenities, but also the rest of the city can go to these wonderful restored spaces. And I talk about the restoration, but Lisa, you've seen it. I mean, it's been restored to what I would consider to be museum quality. And the reason that's important is we recognize that as Detroit is coming back, these gems will be around another 100 years or so. And you want people to take away the memories from superior buildings and superior architects that not only represents the past, but also, frankly, represents Detroit today.
So, of course, Bedrock is known for its adaptive reuse, which is a very hot topic these days. City Modern is a neighborhood infill project in a historic area known as Brush Park.
Yes.
It really is good urbanism. There's a lot of different types and varieties of housing at different price points. Beautiful design. It's walkable. It has green space. And it's very close to downtown. Bedrock, of course, has other large-scale infill projects in the works. Tell us a little bit about those and how you're thinking about them.
Sure. Well, you know, the cities must have a variety of living spaces, right? Because at the end of the day, you want to appeal to everybody in the spectrum. You want places for the youth. You want spaces for, frankly, the elderly. You want spaces for those with high incomes, and you want spaces for those who may have a lower income profile, because great cities are filled with the diversity of people and income. And so we have to, in recognition of that fact, you have to create real estate that accommodates that spectrum. And City Modern is a fantastic example of taking sort of an area that's slightly to the edge, if you will, of the downtown core, and using a variety of different architects to do what is a traditional master plan community, so that each building has its own character and recreate a neighborhood as if it were built over time, and yet it was built at once with a variety of different incomes. And, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the excitement that people have, those who live there. In that vein, we're looking again to the riverfront, which we think is another area where we can create the true diversity of both income and people and ideas adjacent to the Detroit River, and more importantly, right adjacent to the world-class Riverwalk that exists there. And we already own quite a bit of property, including offices there. We're looking at housing opportunities in that area, certainly intermingled with parks that are programmed appropriately. And the notion, again, is to really bring that up to a level that people can totally appreciate a new way of living on the Detroit riverfront.
Speaking of the riverfront development, that is what Bedrock is now doing in Cleveland, which is also a city that's had its ups and downs. Let's talk a little bit about the master plan that you have in development and also about the recently announced practice facility for the Cleveland Cavaliers.
So, as you recall, Lisa, Tower City was, as I think I mentioned it earlier, is one of the core assets in the downtown that I remember when I was first in Cleveland with the Browns. And unfortunately, you know, with the flight to suburbia and other areas, it's seen better days. But it's still in the center of downtown and still seen quite fondly by many folks in Cleveland who remember its heyday. So it's just this wonderful opportunity to see if we can stitch the city center back from the river to Tower City in a manner that is much more reminiscent of, frankly, the great riverfront communities in the world. And those riverfront communities are first and foremost accessible. The rivers are accessible, that is. The riverfront areas are full of public plazas and spaces that are active and activated constantly and are safe. People feel safe. They also have commerce and retail of sorts. But they also, we have to connect back to sort of the urban core, which is public square. And we believe that the best way to do that is to go through Tower City. So a master plan has been created where Tower City essentially feels more like the old-fashioned marketplace where people can come through public square, from public square through Tower City, buy any of the goods that they would typically get in any marketplace, have some activities inside, but actually traverse all the way down to the riverfront through some parks and activated spaces and plazas with a really active river walk.
It's so interesting because when I first saw the master plan for this, it was one of those situations that seemed so obvious and yet profound. I mean, I guess maybe because that speaks to, you know, having grown up in Cleveland, somehow we knew something like this needed to happen, but we just didn't come up with the right idea.
To create a safe and active place, one has to bring people down there. Not only the tourist type people, the casual recreational person, but people have to live there. And so the crux of the redevelopment is really around the creation of about 2,000 homes for 2,000 families on that riverfront that happen to merge those homes and residential living with all the commercial activity and the thoroughfares up to and through Tower City. And every master plan always seeks an anchor development that not only is significant enough that people recognize it as, wow, this is a big deal and worthy of the title anchor, but also actually pushes the fundamental premises of the theory behind the master plan. And in this particular instance, the theory behind the master plan is we will bring people from the rest of the city into and to the riverfront. We will provide the attractive facilities that will bring people and attract people to the riverfront. The Cleveland Cavaliers are a very attractive organization, if you will. People in Cleveland love their Cavaliers. And Cavs have this wonderful vision of bringing the players back from their practice, back from Independence, which is about 40 minutes away, and bringing those players back to Cleveland was a big deal for the Cleveland Cavaliers. But the Cleveland Cavaliers have teamed up with a world-class hospital and healthcare institute in the Cleveland Clinic. And the Cleveland Clinic's vision is of a global sports performance facility, which not only is available and accessible to the world-class athletes, but also to the daily athletes. By opening it to the public, is that all manner of folks who are involved in sports in some way or another, or maybe not involved in sports, but may have an untoward sports injury, will find their way to this facility that sits on the riverfront. And I get excited by it because I just recognize the thousands of people that will be drawn to the facility and therefore drawn to the riverfront, either for a glimpse of the Cleveland Cavaliers and enjoying the riverfront, or actually because they may have to tend to some physical injury or so.
You know, I've had a theory for many years that places like Cleveland and Detroit would experience a resurgence as a result of climate change, because coastal cities and arid climates are going to become too difficult to live. Great Lake cities have fresh water, a wide variety of housing, a lot of underutilized infrastructure, and they do tend to be less prone to natural disasters. What do you think about this theory? And if true, what should Midwestern cities be doing to prepare for what could be an acceleration of the revitalization that's already been going on?
I would say it's probably more than a theory. There are people who are beginning to create economic models around that very premise. I have a very good friend who actually works with a person called Parag Khanna, who has written a book around sort of climate change and the natural effect of pushing people much more towards the Great Lakes region. While you have this theory and others are writing books about it, it's not necessarily something that's widely known. People are still flocking from California and going down to, you know, Phoenix, Arizona, and then wondering, or Texas, and wondering why they're getting hit with, you know, 115 degrees heat for 4 weeks. Maybe when they realized that, if they had realized that they could come out to the Great Lakes region and deal with more milder summers than that, they might have made a different decision. But once you acknowledge that this is a real opportunity, then you build your opportunities and potential around those, that acknowledgement. And I think that's important. But yes, there's more affordable housing, certainly in this region, as you know. Certainly, many would say there's much more family friendly. You literally have to list all those things that people believe are in the public perception about the Great Lakes. You know, just list them negatively and positively, and you need to go down each and every one of them and come up with a campaign to actively show that indeed, one, it's not quite the case they thought, or two, if it is indeed truthfully the case, that you make some real inroads into changing the fact and then changing the perception. There are so many people today who have not been to Detroit before, and then they get here and they actively say, wow, I never thought it was like this. This is not what I thought at all.
I think another interesting factor for these cities is the investment that the United States government is making in industrial policy again for the first time in maybe 50 years. There's a huge investment to reboot manufacturing. And I'm wondering what you think about how cities can welcome manufacturing back into the urban core, close to city centers, so that people can take advantage of being in the city and still have manufacturing jobs.
First of all, let me acknowledge you are absolutely right. The recent moves towards bringing much more industry and advanced manufacturing to the Midwest is, frankly, I can only applaud that, because let's face it, the Midwest folks know how to build things. It's in their DNA, as I put it. And there's a lot of natural resources, frankly, around here. And there are many old industrial plants that could be either torn down, placed, and that requires planning, and that also requires money. So one would hope that the various political entities who are studying this are really thinking about, one, where the best places to plan these facilities and accommodate them, and two, to get ahead of the game and literally start the process of clearing so that it makes the path easier for those industrial facilities to actively get into those sites. One of the positive outcomes from COVID and the supply chain disruptions that we all saw is that many manufacturers realized that while they may want to retain some of their offshore manufacturing facilities, the disruption was so great, they probably need to try to create facilities closer to the OEMs. And so that is creating high demand for, frankly, international folks who are manufacturers who are part of the automobile supply chain to try to bring facilities closer to the big three in some fashion. And that's been healthy for certainly the Midwest.
If you were going to imagine Detroit and Cleveland in 25 years, what's your best case scenario?
Well, I think there would be a significant repopulation of those cities. One, because if the current trends continue, there will be more and more people seeking to come to these two great cities to find jobs. Many of the folks currently living in those cities will stay in those cities because every opportunity they're looking for will be right there. The newly borns will not think of leaving and will stay because, again, they will satisfy both their professional, emotional, and entertainment needs all in their cities and certainly in their regions. And therefore, the population will grow. But in order for that to be true, the cities must create the variety of opportunities that would indeed attract people. The reasons that people leave en masse have everything to do with economics for the most part. And that's why many of these Midwestern cities grew so much, because folks came from the South for the jobs, industrial jobs. Understanding that trend has existed in history, I think we can recreate those trends for the future. But We have to do it knowing and understanding that we have to build cities differently.
I think one of the key features is going to be not letting cities continue to sprawl ever outward to really concentrate redevelopment in a compact way, because Detroit and Cleveland suffered population loss and yet still continued to sprawl ever outwards.
Yes, but well, again, I think we always have to look back and say, well, why did things happen the way they did, in order to assure that those factors don't drive us to make those same decisions. In the past, look, Detroit was Motor City, right? And we all know the terrible history of urban renewal. And then we know all about white flight out of urban areas into the suburbs. And my point is, you have to know your history so that when you are recreating the future, the downtown specifically, you are making conscious choices around better transit, more livable spaces, certainly a variety of different kinds of jobs in the downtown, providing, you know, the classic 15-minute, 18-hour cities. People need to feel that they can accommodate most of their needs without necessarily getting into a car. And that's important as part of how we think about rebuilding these new cities. And in 25 years, I would suspect that we're obviously into the electric vehicle age. The cars are much more like computers than they are anything else. And so we're thinking much more about autonomous vehicles in some fashion. And we have to just plan our cities to accommodate where that's going, which again means more thinking about technology in as part of the urban infrastructure, technology in the streets, technology in the lights, etc., to provide a greater degree of safety, to allow people, frankly, to live and be themselves.
Finally, let's close with this question. Who do you admire and why?
Well, I must say that I've been really fortunate over the course of my career to have worked with some really interesting people who I've had the pleasure of just watching how they work, how they think. But right now, I will say that the short answer to my question is I really admire the Gilbert family. I admire them for not so much what they're doing, it's how they're doing it, how they think about what they're doing, the selflessness associated with it. And frankly, the passion that they bring to the table every time, and the way we're able to have these conversations about how to think about the next 10 years and the emphasis on doing what is right, and where the Gilbert family's mantra is to do things for more than profit. And that drives a number of the decisions we make. And so I've got to say, I've been fortunate enough to have been around some very successful people, but this guiding philosophy of doing the right thing and doing things for more than profit, I think is probably one of the more noble things that I've experienced. And so I will say unequivocally that they are the ones that I most admire.
Well, that sounds like a great place to end. Thank you so much, Kofi. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to seeing you in Detroit very soon.
Yes, yeah, see you soon. Thank you.
Lisa, that was awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that conversation you had with Kofi. It seemed like you guys could have gone on forever.
He's so great to talk to.
You and I will be in Kofi's backyard next week as well, as we head to Detroit for the World Economic Forum's Urban Transformation Summit, gathering of 200 or so public and private sector leaders from around the world. I'm excited because we're going to be sitting down with multiple attendees from across the world and bringing you their insights in upcoming episodes of the City Edge podcast.
We're going to be talking with people from all over the world, and we're going to have lots of things to share, from the energy transition to mobility innovations to even a session on activating the 24-hour city.
So that's it for today, everyone. For more about the future of cities and about the business of city building, make sure to visit cityh.com, subscribe to our newsletter, follow us on LinkedIn. We will see you next time here on the City Edge podcast.